You know, with the eclipse coming up, this would normally be the moment I ask if we really think we're alone in the world, but come on, the three of us are all in agreement on this. There's no way we're alone.
I think we're alone now.
Well, obviously, there's people listening to us right now.
You know, I'm talking about outside of Earth.
Well, you know, there is the space station up there somewhere. Astronauts.
I know. Are there any elves out there? Any alien life forms?
You know, I feel like, to quote a famous comedian, I feel like we're the planet that when they drive by, they lock their car doors. Anyways, did you guys remember your glasses?
Uh-oh. Wait a minute. When does the eclipse happen? Ah!
Oh, Lord. I told you.
There are too many cartoons, but they'll watch them all. The Penny and James can sort of hopefully funny cartoon podcast.
Hello, everyone. I'm James Irish.
I'm Pembroke W. Corgi.
And I'm Chrissy Harding.
Welcome once again to the Pemmy, Chrissy, and James kind of sort of hopefully funny cartoon podcast. And I'm reading blind thanks to forgetting my safety glasses for the eclipse.
Surprisingly enough, I think they're in the back pockets of your pants, dude.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I guess you could say you got mooned.
That doesn't happen often, especially when it's the moon that does it to you.
Although, given your taste in art and drawings, Pemmy, I'm surprised it doesn't happen to me more often.
No!
You gotta love those commissions.
What can I say? I'm a butt man.
Everyone has their thing.
So, today we are talking Alf, the very quick-lived 80s pop culture phenomenon. And while walking through the halls of my day job, I got to thinking about ALF in its greater context culturally as a more advanced part of a wave of 1960s nostalgia. It seems every decade has a fascination with revisiting what came 20 years before it, sometimes overtly with Happy Days for the 1970s, and that 70s show in the 1990s. The 80s, while it had an overt example of that with the dramedy The Wonder Years, also saw a revival of sorts of the wild concept sitcom. Programs like Bewitched, My Favorite Martian, I Dream of Jeannie. Basically, an out-of-the-human-experience element intruding on our mundane lives.
Did you say Bewitched? Hello, I'm your Uncle Arthur.
Are you feeling okay there, James?
Mark and Rennie presaged this format's comeback in the late 1970s and staying into the early 80s, while syndication would see shows like Small Wonder and a revival of the Munsters. ALF, however, was the most prominent example of this format's full comeback, being on NBC in prime time and occupying a not insignificant portion of cultural headspace with kids growing up in that decade.
Okay, David Ogden Steers, knock it off.
I'm sorry, I blacked out. Did I just go into peak overindulgence again?
Yes.
Just a tad.
You'd think I was trying to write a history book and not a silly podcast about cartoons.
You gained an accent and everything. It was kind of amazing.
Yeah, dude, you were definitely channeling like David Ogden Steers when he like played Cogsworth in Beauty and the Beast. Like, you need to back it off there a little bit.
Okay, I promise no more of that for the next half hour of the podcast.
You assume that we can keep this podcast in under a half hour. That's very bold of you.
That's why I'm only promising that long. I don't know if I can last that much longer without lapsing.
That's fair.
So ALF was the affectionate nickname of Gordon Shumway, an inadvertent visitor to Earth from the planet Melmac, who spent a good 4 seasons of sitcom shenanigans being kept hidden by the Tanner family from the world at large, ranging from nosy neighbors Trevor and Raquel to whoever happened to be driving the plot of the day. This head case with a hankering for house cats was the creation of puppeteer Paul Fusco and writer-director Tom Patchett, the latter of whom had worked with the Jim Henson Company on 2 films, including Muppets Take Manhattan, and took a lot of the lessons from that company and applied it to the sitcom staging, basically building the set up to give Paul room to maneuver around and puppeteer. What worked for The Muppet Show with a single guest and usually sets they had to purpose build for each scenario would frequently be a nightmare working on the set of ALF with its more permanent sets.
I think it was interesting with Tom Pratchett actually having to work for Jim Hansen was when they first pitched this idea of the sitcom was they kind of told Paul, well, it's not Jim Hansen, so we kind of don't want any part of it because they considered Jim Hansen to be like the premier puppeteer at the time. It was interesting reading that about when he first kind of came up with the idea of ALF. They were like, well, you know, you're not Jim Hansen, so we don't want any part of this. He was like, excuse me. So someone did take a shot at him, so which was kind of cool. And we have ALF.
Yeah, if I remember right, the guy who played Willie on ALF has a lot of not happy memories of being on that show.
Yeah, reportedly, after the last day of filming, he didn't attend the rap party. He just went straight home. But ALF spawned comic books, video games, plush toys, all the various hallmarks of a multimedia hit in that era, and an animated series was all but inevitable. And where there was animated media tie-ins in the late 1980s, there was Deke.
We just can't escape them this year, can we?
This is our fourth podcast about a Deke production this year.
I think this is our year of Deke.
Boy, so many things I want to say to that, and I'm just not.
Yeah, don't touch it, dude. Our year of torture isn't over with yet, though, from what I've seen of the schedule.
We're going to be begging for more Deke after the next three episodes.
Begging Send for help. More Deke, gosh.
I know. Send help.
Given ALF has a history on a whole different planet and alludes to pastimes there like beluga baseball, there was no shortage of material for Deke to create what amounts to a prequel series detailing Gordon's life on Melmac, especially with Fusco and Patchett directly involved with the creation of the show. It basically centers around a, quote, teenage, unquote, Gordon living in East Velcro, yes, that's the name of the suburb, with his family and hanging out with his friends Rip, Skip, and Rhonda, who occasionally get called into service as reserve members of the Melmacian Orbit Guard.
Which is interesting in and of its own right. I like the fact that they bring these three back because we do hear a lot about them in the actual live action show. Of course, Deke also couldn't really screw this up because the show gave them so much background material to use for this show. It's like, it kind of wrote itself.
But yes, ALF's friends did appear on the sitcom very briefly in puppet form on the episode Help Me, Rhonda.
Mm-hmm.
Though looking quite a bit different, I'll say that.
Yeah.
Now, the premise might sound pretty pedestrian when I put it as simply as I did a moment ago, but the eccentric imaginations of ALF's creators take full advantage of this broad canvas before them.
They really do. The Martian landscapes and just the cities, all of the buildings, the equipment they use, everything is so creative and so just bizarre. And I really like the look of this show, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, being on an alien world gives you more freedom to just go with it, which is nice because it's like you're not really restricted to Earth logic, in a sense. You can get away with a little bit more. And it's cool how they play things that we think of as things that we sit here and we're like, oh, that's what that is. And then they do stuff on Melmac that's totally different, but you still have a frame of reference for it. And you're just like, wow, that's what's most important in your world. You pick that, you know, and for a kid, it's funny, which is cool.
Now we should mention character designs are by someone we've seen before, Phil Barlow.
He did the character designs for Captain N, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. And that will come into play a little later on.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I do think his, how should I put this? Imaginative and weird designs work a lot better here than it does in Captain N.
This is more his speed.
Yes.
He definitely shines in this show better than he did in Captain N.
Now, for vocal talent, naturally, Paul Fusco is present as Alf / Gordon in both the live-action wraparound segments and to perform the voice of the character in the animated main body of the show. Since he's called Gordon on the show, but let's face it, we all know him as Alf, we'll be using both names interchangeably. And Paul Fusco also voices Gordon's friend Rick Fusterman.
With a very exaggerated stutter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But not an over-the-top Porky Pig one. It's just a nervous tick, and it's not the character's source of comedy either.
No,
it's just a part of the character, but it's not the defining feature of Rick, which is nice. You know, if you were a kid with a stutter, it was nice. It's a nice representation, but it doesn't make it the source of the humor. It's not mocking. Yeah, it's an endearing quality to Rick, which I like.
We also have Tabitha St. Germain again.
Woo!
Still under the pseudonym Paulina Gillis, as we last saw her in Legend of Zelda, as Alf's little sister Augie, and as his girlfriend Rhonda. Already showing off her range.
Even though she didn't voice Rhonda in the live-action show when she appeared in that. That was a different actress. Just wanted to mention that. But no, I'm always just happy to mention Tabitha St. Germain. Met her once. She's a really cool, nice lady. So props to her.
Yeah, she definitely has range to her, and it's always good to see her showing up in a show.
The rest of Alf's family are parental figures Bob, played by Thick Wilson. Who names their kids Thick?
It also could be a stage name, too.
Probably.
I do want to say I personally like it that his dad is named Bob, because Bob is actually my dad's name, so that's just bonus cool to me.
I know my dad's name was Bob too. Sure, for Robert, he hated Robert, so everyone called him Bob.
And Mother Flo, voiced by Peggy Mahone, and little brother Curtis, voiced by Michael Fantini. Thick Wilson also performs the series' primary bad guy, Larson Petty, with Dan Hennessy as both of his henchmen, Sloop and Egbert.
Larson Petty, it's such a good pun.
I know. It's great. Petty Larson, I love it. I love it when they have fun with villains' names like that. Like, in Cops, like Misdemeanor.
Yes.
It's such a good pun name. I love it.
Actually, I think
Misdemeanor is indeed a Tabitha St. Germain character.
That's what I thought. I was like, wait a minute. Isn't she also Tabitha St. Germain?
Marla Lukowski, a veteran of Deke's Care Bears work, principally as Good Luck Bear, and Len Carlson, who we last heard as Ganon on the Zelda tune, voice various other supporting characters that we'll no doubt be running into as we proceed forward.
Yep. I don't know if we run into Maria's characters as we run into Len Carlson's.
Yeah, because Stella doesn't appear in either of these episodes. And I think that's who she voiced.
Yeah.
Oh, well. So, Good Luck Bear was the best Care Bear. Well, either him or Grumpy.
Yeah. My sister had a Good Luck Bear.
I had a Good Luck Bear. We still have it somewhere here in the house.
Yeah. My mom sold all of our stuffed Care Bears when we had to move, because it was literally like, my mom was in the mode of like, I'm selling it because I'm not moving it when we moved from the big house to the apartment. And I couldn't stop her, unfortunately.
Though I will say, Bedtime Bear is the one I'm envious of.
I think as we determined from the last podcast, we are all envious of anyone who's able to get a really good night's sleep and not wake up for anything.
Well, before our Alf podcast turns into a Care Bears podcast.
Or a therapy session.
No, that's every podcast.
That's fair. That is quite fair.
Let's begin with the beginning. The Phantom Pilot, written by Michael Marer, whose other credits include episodes of Hanna-Barbera's Richie Rich, story work on Skatebirds and Slap Olympics, and single-handedly scripting the entire 13-episode run of the animated series based on the Karate Kid movies.
Is that on the list?
Kind of low on the list.
I have not rewatched that any times recently, but I do know it's on, if I remember, I think it's on either Netflix or I think it's on Tubi, actually, the Karate Kid cartoon. All I remember about that is I saw a couple episodes as a kid and did not dig it. So
maybe if we do another summer blockbuster month.
That's fair.
Puppet Alf introduces us to the framing device of most of the episodes of the show. Him writing his memoirs of his days before Melmac blew up.
I will say he also introduced the fact that his actual real name is Gordon Shumway. And that's because he's like, yeah, that's my name, before they started calling me Alf.
And as we check in on him from the Tanner Garage, it turns out he just finished up Chapter 1, The Phantom Pilot, which is a sneaky way to get the name for the test episode of his series into the title.
You know what? It's a clever reference.
It is.
It is.
I give him kudos for that.
I'm not saying it isn't. Both things are true.
Yeah.
The cartoon begins with Sergeant Staff, Len Carlson, doing a roll call from the Orbital Guard's headquarters right next to their flying aircraft carrier. Now, where have I seen that before?
Hmm.
I don't know, but Sergeant Staff kind of gives me some Ganon vibes just by his design.
Yeah.
Yeah, enough said.
And his attitude.
Amidst the crowd of cadets going, yo, everyone called, Rick is worried that Gordon is going to miss the call. But Skip, voiced by Rob Cowan in one of his few reoccurring voice roles in a relatively short career, isn't fazed.
Yeah, he's completely chillaxed about this whole thing. He's like, stop worrying. He'll be here. He's fine. I don't know what you're worried about.
Yeah, he's pretty much the Fonz of the show.
At the Shumway home, Flo shouts Gordon awake, and the youngster realizes he's only got 5 minutes to get there. And Pem? Let's talk about the visual design of this house.
I kind of love it. It looks like that house that you'd kind of design as a child. You'd put like tubes to get everywhere and like the beds. I just, like I said earlier, I love the designs in this show. They're so imaginative. I love that they have like little chute like tubes to get to from their room to like the kitchen. And it's very imaginative, very unique. I love that his bed is like held up from the roof. Isn't there like real beds like that?
Yeah, there are beds like that. Oh god, I think they have them in like those treehouse motels.
I'm not sure how comfortable that would be, but it's very unique. Also, Gordon's very obsessed with cats. I mean, I understand it's his favorite food, but jeez, even on his bed.
Well, I mean, everything food wise is cat themed in this world. Like,
the unless it's salad.
Yeah, like the Cat's Up Diner, the Mooncat Ripple, Cat Fudge Sundae.
While he doesn't wear it in this particular episode, I do want to say that I wish I had. I want Gordon's Hawaiian shirt that he wears when he's not at work, because I actually think that's a pretty cool shirt. I would totally wear that.
I mean, come on. Even the opening theme is sung by singing cats, which, can we talk about the opening theme song and how catchy that is?
It is very catchy. Also, it is very well animated.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It is probably one of the better opening theme songs that I've seen in a while. Like, I really enjoy it.
The animation in the show in general is just really good. So, you know, take that, all you people who keep calling, all you people in the industry calling Deke do it cheaply. Granted, I have a feeling they got a better budget for this show than some of their other projects. But
probably.
This was probably their A-team that was given like this show to do. But come on, we call Deke do it cheaply. So like, we're in that crowd too.
I think Deke is one of those companies that you can definitely tell when they're given a bigger budget to make their show. With that said, I do really love the design of the house. Even just the out of the house looks really neat. Like, yeah. I said, everything is designed really neatly in this show. It's very imaginative. It's very cool. Very alien, but yeah, very fun.
Yeah.
So the roll call continues as Gordon races through breakfast, quickly greets his family, and promises to hover carefully since he hasn't gotten the brakes on his hover car fixed. Oh, and he has to pick up the laundry.
That's going to become a thing.
That is very much going to become a thing.
Also, forgot to fix your brakes. I'll hover safely. It's like, you've got no brakes, man.
Yeah, like, it's like, oh, I've when his dad's like, did you fix the brakes on the hover car yet? No, I forgot to do that. I'll just hover very carefully. Like, isn't that a kind of very important thing to get the
brakes? You can't stop.
Like, you can't stop the car.
Sergeant Staff is through to the letter N as Gordon hovers straight into a traffic jam across a wild freeway and has to improvise a way around it.
Where are the cops, by the way?
Directing traffic.
Fair enough.
He crashes into the roll call just as Sergeant Staff calls his name.
And Skip goes, see, I told you.
If nothing else, Gordon makes use of the flower bush he ran into by giving it to Rhonda as a gift.
I do have to say, Gordon's and Sergeant Staff's, comments to each other makes me wonder how Gordon hasn't been kicked out of the reserve, because it's literally like, Gordon, look what you've done to my building. Look what your building did to my car!
I kind of wonder if being in the Orbital Guard, it's like required service, so he really can't get kicked out. It's like they have to take part in it. So like as much as the staff, Sergeant Staff wants to get rid of him, he's just like, I just have to deal with you for a couple more months. Like, just have to deal with you kind of thing. Like, they have to serve a certain amount of time as part of their citizenship.
So they're interrupted by Colonel Cantfail, another Len Carlson voice character, who scolds the Sarge for the messy state of his facility and uniform. Wait a minute. There's something familiar about this Colonel.
I just love his name is Cantfail.
Yeah, he's giving me some vibes of...
I know, it's very familiar. It feels like we've seen this character before in another show.
The wild, slicked back hair sticking up.
It's blonde, pompous.
The barrel-chested shape of the upper body. The confident swagger. Is that Simon Belmont's brother from another star system?
Belmont, Vampire Hunter. Also finder of lost dogs, pussycats, and loved ones.
And aliens.
Apparently.
Like we said, Phil Barlow.
That's fair. Yeah.
The world of animation is a truly tangled web sometimes.
Or just an incestual relationship at this point.
Can I at least give some props to Len Carlson in this scene? Because he's literally voicing two characters that are conversing with each other, and you wouldn't know it if you didn't look it up practically. It's one of those scenes where the voice actor is pretty much talking to himself, and I always love it when I see scenes like that, because especially when it's done really well and you can't really tell that it's not two people. I mean,
I agree. If I did not know that he was voicing both characters, I would not know that it wasn't two distinctly different voice actors doing this scene, because you really can't tell that he's arguing with himself, which I wonder if that's what it's like with my voices in my head.
So after Gordon is ordered to clean up, he's then volunteered by the Sarge for a mission that could risk his life. Old Gord tries to back out, but the Sarge won't have it. And we next find Gordon looking less than amused at the sight of soldiers walking into one door and coming out horribly wounded just from the training.
I do also want to mention that I do like the slight little visual gag of Gordon being told to clean up the place, picks up the rock, and then told to volunteer and drops the rock right on Staff's foot. Don't!
I'm reminded, when I watched it, I was like, oh, so that's where Oscar picked up those tricks of peeing on the person yelling at him. Got it.
So Gordon is given a crash course on piloting, which has more ill effect on the people around him than himself.
That's fair.
A bout of random spinning, notwithstanding.
I guess it spins him right round, baby, like a record, baby. Record right round, round.
Well, he has his own spin on things.
Once lunch is called, to the dismay of the people who got sick just watching the training...
Or to my dismay of seeing that announcing box. Am I wrong in feeling that that's mildly creepy looking, considering it's literally looks like one of the Melmacian snouts?
Yes, you are completely correct. Of course, if you think about an animation when they do it on Earth, they make the announcement box look like a pair of lips yelling at us. So kind of a direct translation kind of thing, because it wouldn't make sense to make it look like a human mouth yelling at them. So making it look like a Malmackian mouth makes sense.
It still looks like they just cut off someone's face and put it on theirs.
I agree.
Yeah, yeah. So on his way, Gordon spots Rhonda getting into a test cockpit. Turns out her dad was a pilot, and in the process of Gordon trying desperately to show off, it turns out she knows more than Gordon about nearly the whole process.
Yeah.
He tried.
He did try. I give him credit.
I actually feel a little bad for him because, like, he keeps his confident swagger, you know, in front of her, but as soon as he leaves, you can just see him kind of slumped walk off.
Because he kind of knew he blew it.
Yep.
Yeah, he also doesn't get a chance to see how good she really is.
Which is a pity.
Which is a pity. Because he does strike me as someone, if he saw it, he would have been a big cheerleader for her.
Well, of course. Yeah. Alf's not sexist, he's just dense.
That's true.
And maybe a little egotistical.
Yeah, but what protagonist in these cartoons isn't slightly egotistical?
Just then, an invasion alert comes over the PA system. This is not a drill. This isn't even a pop quiz. This is real. According to Can't Fail, Larson Petty's fleet is coming to Melmac via the Dire Straits.
So money's for nothing.
Yeah.
And the colonel rallies his pilots to intercept. Rhonda shows up as Gordon is washing aircrafts, and he still tries to impress by saying if he's called, he'll be ready.
And he's called.
Yeah, that's the exact moment the colonel mistakes Gordon for his co-pilot, Flukeson. And no matter how he protests, the colonel won't listen.
Hey, you know, there's that pompousness again that I'm not wrong.
A completely unprepared Alf has to improvise right on the front line, trying to activate the radar and just getting his mother scolding him for not picking up the laundry.
That was good.
I also want to mention something on that, which is Alf gives a gasp response, but the gasp response I don't think is voiced by Fusco, because I've heard Deke use that exact same gasp sound in like other cartoons, specifically like the Super Mario Super Show.
Oh, yeah. Well, Deke does recycle stuff.
Any animation company recycles stuff.
That's fair. Hey, save money.
A far more ominous ship holds the vial, wicked and rather gaunt, Larson Petty, who is vowing revenge for, well, here for yourself.
Now to get even with that rotten colonel for unfairly booting me out of the Orbit Guard.
Oh, well, sir, you did blow up the Zucchini Building, steal the statue of Bob the Great, and insult the colonel's mother. But she was asking for it.
He's got better reason to be pissed than most of the villains in some of these shows, honestly.
To be fair,
she had it coming.
He had it coming.
Larson orders evasive maneuvers when he realizes the colonel is right there, while Alf performs a standard misunderstanding of military lingo.
The oldest joke in the book.
Listen, it's right there. It's low-hanging fruit. He had to go for it. I'm sorry.
They even used it in Last Crusade, so...
I know! It's like, come on, you're doing a military episode. You have to at least do the joking about, you know, O'Clock somewhere in there. Yeah.
For those who need to cotton to what we're talking about, the colonel says, enemies at 3 o'clock. Alf says, well, it's 2:30 now. That gives us plenty of time.
Yeah, we have half an hour.
The colonel orders Gordon to fire a missile with all kinds of doodads, and he hits one of theirs.
It's not his fault they dodged. He would have hit that ship, except they dodged.
I do like the... Another just props to Lynn Carlson. I love the just disappointed but still trying to sound pompous like delivery from Can't Fail in that scene. It's like, that was one of ours. Almost Shatner-ish.
Exactly.
Again, this missile.
I know.
It's the Swiss Army knife of missiles.
I feel like it's something that would have been in SWAT Cats.
I could actually see that.
Exactly. Like, I'm like, oh, I, I, Okay, apparently Razor's been trading notes with these guys. Awesome.
SWAT cats? I think you mean Fast Food the Cartoon. Ha!
Nice.
Nice.
I kill me! Ha!
As the Sarge and Rhonda watch, the latter excuses herself because she has to call her neck.
Comb her neck.
Oh, comb her neck.
I'll redo that then. I heard call.
I heard comb, and I think that also makes more sense. But
well, I thought it was just the trope of I'm making up a really lame excuse. When, you know, where you say you have to iron the dishes and wash the laundry.
Listen, I thought we keep this whole entire banter in there because I think this is fun.
Yeah.
Either way.
You in the comments, what did you hear? Oh, wait, you didn't. Go watch this on YouTube and tell us what you heard.
Exactly.
Either way, poor Gordon can't get the hang of what he's doing and just reels Larson closer to their craft, giving Petty the chance to launch his secret weapon, a device that traps the Colonel in a blinded game of Guess Who.
Which I think is actually, I thought this was hilariously funny.
If anything, that is, there's a lot of just clever ideas in this.
Yeah.
I thought that was good when he did it. Guess who? Margaret. And I'm like, what? Who's Margaret?
As Gordon starts recording an audio will, a mysterious pilot flies in and undoes the rope holding the two crafts together.
Which causes Larson Petty's craft to crash into one of his own.
Well, he was flying so quick because he was dragging the other one. Then it was like, zip. And it's like the, what is it? The slingshot effect?
Effect.
Speaking of which, the crash animation on that had a freeze frame in there that I'm going to have to show you guys. It won't work for a thumbnail, but I definitely got to show you guys.
Okay, would you mind describing it for our listening audience then?
Yes, but I will send it to you guys in the...
For goodness sakes!
This is how you know this was animated by a Japanese studio.
Or it was included in the notes by these people who are noted comedians and satirists.
Oh my god. This falls under images that are still true today.
But yeah, it does... This is really common in anime, which is one of the reasons I had to mention it. But yeah, when they crash, there's a lot of things flashing, mostly stars and explosions and stuff. But if there's a freeze frame where it's literally the Statue of Liberty in front of the American flag and it just says America.
Oh, you should put that up on the Instagram page.
I should.
I'm glad I caught that though, because I was just like, wait a second.
When you can shade yourself. I love it. Self-burns. Those are rare.
As everyone wonders who that phantom pilot is while she winks at Gordon, the Sarge says the pilot is under arrest for flying a craft without a permit. This plot thread is never mentioned again in this episode.
I'm pretty sure Can't Fly probably told them to drop it.
Well, there's two... I can give two possible suggestions for this. They needed something for the commercial stinger. Two, she arguably saves everybody at the end of the episode, so drops it.
Still, a quick throwaway line would have helped.
I'm not arguing that. Grant, for all we know, that could have been in the deleted scenes or something that got dropped because of time.
Probably. Yeah. Oh, and yes, of course it's Rhonda.
Of course.
Of course.
Of course! Sorry. Having a Street Fighter flashback.
This is also another trope of this time period was the mysterious person who saves their life, and it's always the girl character that no one would suspect. They did it by Meister Mars.
So Alf returns home, sans laundry, and brags about knowing the Phantom Pilot to his family, though correcting himself by saying she winked at him. The boring TV show the kids are watching is interrupted by news of a second invasion, with Can't Fail's Air Force trapped in sticky gross stuff.
That could also be the other reason why he had to kind of drop it, was like he couldn't really investigate it when you're getting invaded for a second time.
Mm, yeah.
Larson Petty's is definitely determined today.
He must have had his Wheaties.
Augie tosses her pudding at the on-scene reporter right through the TV because it's funny.
I mean, yeah.
Kid's got aim, man. Kid's got aim.
Alf races off to risk his life again and wonders what it is with his mother and laundry.
I know, because she yells at him, don't forget the laundry.
Gordon, if you only knew.
Honey, it doesn't go away. It just gets more insistent.
As the crew on the helicarrier wonder how to save the planet, the Phantom Pilot arrives and asks for a volunteer. And yes, Gordon is too love-struck to not run away with the rest.
Hey.
You know,
it works. Is what it is, yep. You know? If he ran with the rest, we wouldn't have the rest of this episode, now would we?
You know what? I'll take that over the usual, like, everyone just takes a step back and they count the person, so...
Yeah, sure. they all just ran for it.
It's a worthy variation.
Yeah.
Within downtown Velcro, Petty is dropping double-ply garbage bags filled with the same gunk the planes are stuck in. This being his grand revenge on Melmac.
It stinks.
This is pretty villainous, to be honest. But yeah. It's also very petty, so I get why he has his name.
Yeah.
The Phantom Pilot tisks him. And as they're getting ready to attack, Gordon hits the ejector on her seat. Why do they even have that button?
Don't!
Wrong lever!
I do like some of Gordon's just throwaway dialogue on that, though. It's like, have we exhausted all disciplinary tactics?
Diplomatic tactics
yet.
So now, once again, he has to improvise, flying through the city and radioing for help, only to get his mom again telling him to get the laundry.
Which also has a good gag. It's like, Mom, I'm trying to save the world. Can't this wait? There might not be a later time. It's like, geez.
His mom is very tenacious.
It's like, if you die, then you can't pick up the laundry. So pick up the laundry.
She does not book any like excuse. Like, you're getting the laundry.
Well, when you consider what we see of in episode 2 and who she's married to, you kind of can't blame her.
Yeah, that's kind of fair.
Switching frequencies, he spots an ad for a donut shop with a big pot of coffee sign and gets an idea.
It's a really cool donut shop, by the way.
Yeah, it is, actually.
It's a big old animatronic donut being dunked. And so Gordon successfully chases Larson in and gets him stuck into that sign's donut.
Also, I just noticed that one of the buildings in that scene just says eek.
They have some of the signs in the background of this episode. If you actually read some of the signs in there, you're just like, wait, what? They have some good ones back there.
Awarded the Melmac Medal of Merit. Ow!
Also, the most obvious of jokes when you pin anything on someone's chest.
Yep.
Gordon admits half the medal belongs to the Phantom Pilot and wonders who she could have been. Rhonda winks at him several times, and all Gordon thinks is there's something in her eye.
She's like, I'll give you a hint, and then she does it, and he's just like, what? Huh? Poor Gordon. Poor Rhonda.
Like I said, he's not sexist, just dense.
That's fair.
She also settles for a cat fudge sundae with him right after he picks up the laundry.
Because, you know, he'd have to deal with his mom.
I just hope he doesn't get the cat fudge all over the laundry.
That's fair.
Good ender for that running gag.
Exactly.
Puppet Alf asks us to tune in next week for a doozy of an episode and then goes off for lunch when he hears Lucky the Cat.
Yeah. Poor Lucky.
We also get a very weird ending segment.
The credits, you mean?
Yeah, the credits is just like, what?
Like, it's all filmed before a live TV audience of cats.
Mm-hmm.
complete like, with Larson Petty holding Augie on his shoulders. So yeah, it's making it look like a literal sitcom. Kind of clever, kind of amusing, but also kind of just weird.
Yeah, you're just like, okay, this is a little odd.
When we return, we go a long, long time ago to a salad bar far, far away.
Commercial alert! Put the VCR on pause!
On our next podcast episode, Shake, Rattle, and Roll sounds like a surefire hit. It's got the voices of Paul Winchell, Lenny Weinrib, Joe E. Ross, and Alan Oppenheimer in a cartoon about ghosts running a hotel for the supernatural. So why is this short subject series so obscure? We look for ourselves in 2 weeks. Oh, don't forget to tip the bellhop. What is with Melmac and condiments anyway?
Yeah, first mayonnaise.
And mayonnaise will crop up again and again and again.
It's mostly mayonnaise that they have an obsession with, actually. And then we get to salad dressing.
Yep.
Which arguably mayonnaise is, so.
Well, it's one of the main ingredients in. You know, Caesar dressing, ranch dressing, most of the cream dressings, actually.
This episode is Salad Wars, written by Dan DiStefano. Have I heard that name before? IMDb, nope.
Well, not in the podcast. We haven't heard this name before.
Yeah, it turns out this is the first we've seen of him in the podcast, but won't be the last time, since he wrote a lot of the episodes of Sport Billy.
Yeah, that's part of our run of torture episodes we'll be dealing with. Sorry, guys. Stop laughing over there, Pemmy. We know this. Why did we let him pick? Oh, yeah, that's right. It was his turn.
Live Action Alf starts this chapter of his memoir on a dark and stormy night, then stops himself because none of his adventures do so. So he makes it a very dark and stormy night.
Alf, Snoopy called. He wants his cliche back.
I was wondering if you didn't say that, I was going to. Snoopy's like, hey.
That's my thing. Hand it back.
The Shumways are on vacation during a sunlit day, not any level of dark, stormy, or night.
I'm also very glad that you did point that part out, because someone needed to.
They're taking a break on their route to Mount Snout when Flo discovers they're close to salad dressing country. Despite Bob's protests, Flo insists, since she's always wanted to see where gooey gardenia comes from, as they leave what Alf describes as lush surroundings, a painted billboard of trees against the desert landscape.
I feel like this is every road trip most people have been on with their family, or at least it's starting out to be.
You know, by Deke standards, this is a pretty good behind the black gag, where we're being withheld information because we're so close up to the scene, and when we pan out, you get the full story.
I agree.
I also agree. I also still want Gordon's Hawaiian shirt. Maybe his dad's Hawaiian shirt in this episode, too, because that's also I'm kind of digging that.
Maybe we need to find you one for your birthday.
Ooh, okay. Now, Mr. Chisholm, a John Wayne sound-alike who hopefully doesn't share his inspiration's thoughts on ethnicity, Pilgrim.
Can I say something on Chisholm?
Yeah. Sure.
I couldn't find proof of this, because I tried, but I feel like 95% certain that that's another voice being done by Paul Fusco.
Could be.
I'm pretty sure it's Paul Fusco doing a John Wayne imitation, because there's a couple of times where he drops the voice and sounds like a lighter Gordon.
It's a possibility.
So Chisholm calls the wagon train forward, thanks to Colorado, his sidekick, putting a coin in Chisholm's kiddie ride horsemobile.
I almost feel like, well, Chisholm sounds a lot like John Wayne. I think he's also just he's almost a parody of a lot of the Western TV shows that were on syndication, you know, like Bonanza, The Rifleman, Gunsmoke, kind of those characters too. So I feel like he's kind of like a conglomerate of all of them, because a lot of them tried to sound like John Wayne too, some of those characters.
Yeah. So, I like the mechanical the mechanical bull, like.
Yeah, or the mechanical horse.
It's a kiddie ride.
It's a kiddie ride.
The kiddie ride mobile, as you put it. I really do like that. That's a cute gag.
That is a cute gag.
So in salad dressing country, the finest flowers are machine sniffed and chomped, and Bob thinks he smells a tourist trap.
He's not wrong.
You know, I wasn't so sure of that myself until I saw the massive talking animatronic welcoming them to Dressing Downs.
Five nights at salad dressing. Also, can I also say that that machine that's sniffing and eating the petals is mildly disturbing?
I think majority of the machines we're going to be seeing in this episode are mildly disturbing.
And not just the machines!
Yeah.
Oh yeah. This is, I would like to state off the bat, I picked this one purely randomly. This was not, I had seen this, like, it's like, oh, I remember this episode and have fond memories. This was ABC, literally it was Eeny, Miney, Moe, Catch a Tiger by the Toe. And I just picked it. Plus the title reminded me of Star Wars.
The Nightmare Fuel episode. Yeah. I don't know about that, but.
It was between this and Ming Goober Night Dream, which I'm like, yeah, good. It was this or the Shakespeare pun one.
So once they're there, Flo immediately wants a rubber chicken hat, which prompts Gordon to ask if they're to go with her matching earrings, belt, and slippers. And he's not joking, at least about the earrings.
Yeah, we don't see the rest of her outfit.
That's some definite earrings. Yeah, I'll just say that.
They are definitely a statement.
Actually, I'll give props to anyone who can wear those in public, I'll be honest. Respect.
Flo definitely strikes me as that touristy mom that will just wear, with no irony whatsoever, she's like, I'm wearing it and I don't care.
So the family heads for the tour, where a less than enthused guide explains the process of making the dressings, and a less than impressed Curtis wants to get back to their planned vacation.
He is a typical kid.
Alf excuses himself for some fresh air, the sheer number of scents overwhelming his considerable snout. And looking for the bathroom, he stumbles on the episode's conflict, which revolves around plastic pussy willow seeds.
Hey, look, Alf, you found the plot.
I thought we were free from the gutter-minded talk after our Dr. Slump episode, but no, no. Now we're confronted with this low-hanging fruit.
Did you not learn that when we have a kid show that has a cast of all male writers, you are never free of gutter-minded talk?
Though I do always wonder, like, can they still say that now? Like, even if it's referenced to Pussy Willow or Pussy Cat or something like that, can you still say that now?
Yes. Yes, you can.
It just feels like you're asking for it.
As long as you are using it in a term of, like, Pussy Willow is an actual plant. You're not saying anything dirty. Pussycat, you might be pushing it. But Pussy Willow, it's an actual term for a plant.
Unless you're Tom Jones.
Yeah, then you're in another hole. We're not touching that. I can't even go down that path.
The man driving the hard bargain is Louis the Pruner, who owns the whole operation, park and all, and his target is a farmer named Albert. Louis's son, Sonny, just wants to put him into the pedal crusher, when Alf shows up and munches a pedal, quipping he prefers the plywood ranch. And oh my! Sonny says the K word!
Yeah, they actually said kill. I was surprised by that too.
I know, that one got by the censors. I'm like, okay, someone was asleep at the wheel on that one.
I also want to say, what was it, Larry the Pruner? That was his name?
Mm-hmm.
That straight up sounds like a Dick Tracy villain.
I agree. I was like, considering that this episode is kind of all plant-based, I'm like, it makes sense for him to be the pruner. But on the same point, I'm like, I'm waiting to see a guy in a yellow trench coat show up now.
As Alf is told to scram, the dim-witted Sonny can't tell if his pop is talking to him or Alf most of the time.
Well, because he keeps calling Alf Sonny.
Yep.
I can't blame the kid on that one. I'd be like, which one are you talking to, Dad? Because I'm Sonny too. That's what happens when you name your kid Sonny.
Flo arrives with the rest of the tour right behind her, and Albert takes advantage of the confusion to skedaddle. Very technical term, that, skedaddle.
I think we need to use that more often in average conversation.
Once Alf assures he'll get the rubber chicken hat for his mom, the tour group leaves with Albert sneaking along with them. And Louie and his cohorts, Sonny and the heavyset Big Buds, who has not yet been named, but will be, move into action.
I thought it would have been funny if they gave him, like, a name that sounded like Cher.
Well, they have to keep, somebody has to keep the plant references going.
I know.
Though Big Buds sounds like, it sounds like a dispensary you'd get in Colorado.
That's fair, too.
More than Colorado these days.
Yep, we have
true, but Colorado's my always my go-to for it, even though Oklahoma's just as bad.
Is it legal in Oklahoma now?
Oh yeah, it is. Not Texas, which is hilarious, but yeah, it is in Oklahoma, which is funny because every time I visit my parents in Oklahoma, like in Ardmore, there's like a dispensary at every street corner. One is a dispensary right next to the retro game store. And I'm like, oh yeah, that goes together.
That actually kind of does, if you think about it.
Yeah.
I love that Oklahoma is more free than Texas right now.
Yeah, I know. It's hilarious. But not going to go into that any more than that.
No. Maybe we can drop it right there.
So the Shumways are getting back into their camper, bound once again for Mount Snout, as Albert plays stowaway, until they're spotted by Sonny and Buds. Following in a harvester, they're so careless they knock over the animatronic from earlier.
Oh boy.
Don't. Those things aren't cheap.
Yeah.
No, they are not.
Now, after the break, it turns out Gordon is a steady hand at the wheel. Until Albert spots his pursuers and leaps into the cab, insisting Alf steps on it.
Before, not even explain, he's like, you need to go. And then he's like, wait, who the hell are you? I think this is the one time that this they actually like get logical.
By the way, can I mention, even though I don't think it'd work very well on a like actual physics level, I do like the patio that's on the camper that his family's on, and Bob is like barbecuing a freaking burger on it.
I love that too. When I saw it, I was like, oh my god, this is, I'm like, did they get this inspiration from like the Barbie Dream Camper that actually had that back in the day? I'm like, because it makes zero sense, and yet somehow people were like, this is a great idea.
It would be amazing if it wasn't for the risk of, you know, falling off.
Exactly. Which they still didn't do during the whole chase sequence, which I'm like,
maybe there's a gravity field.
Maybe.
His family, or at least Flo, seem oblivious to the pursuit, while Gordon and Albert contend with all kinds of mayhem caused by Big Buds and Sonny. That's Gordon fair. Rolls up the windows on the harvester's hands, causing the gloves to come off and the mechanical elements to rub the exposed hands together from the pain.
Nice that was touch. A really nice, yeah, that was a good gag.
That was a really good gag.
The next attack fares better, as the roof of the cab is ripped off and Gordon and Albert are sent into the harvester and hay baled. Big Buds wishes the remaining Shumways happy travels as, without a driver, their camper drives straight off the road. Off a cliff.
Does this mean that Gordon unintentionally bailed on them?
Oh. Sorry, Sunset.
I was about to say, we haven't said sorry to Sunset in like a couple of episodes, so I think we're due.
Flo insists Bob do something as he puts down the mosquito net. Not helping, Bobby boy!
It's something.
I mean, it stops him going flying off the back of the RV.
Mr. Chisholm and Colorado show up, though, and stage a rescue with some wagon wire, successfully saving... Who am I kidding? It's all too fast for a tiny kiddie ride horse to handle, as the camper drags Mr. Chisholm with it. It takes a collision with a rocky outcropping to stop the whole combined mess. I meant to do that.
Yeah. You know, this never happened to the other, you know, Western heroes in their shows.
It's never happened to James Garner.
No,
or Randolph Scott.
Randolph Scott.
So So once the Shumways are properly saved, Chisholm doesn't want to get involved until Colorado spots salad oil, which turns out to be barnacle whip. Only Louis the Pruner fuels his vehicles with it, so Chisholm changes his mind for reasons?
Yeah.
I guess it's because either he has an issue with Larry the Pruner distracting people from his wagon trail, or because it went from, I don't have any idea who did this, to, oh, well, I have a lead now.
Yeah, or he knows Louis the Pruner has a tendency to do some shady stuff.
Either way, he takes Bob and Curtis with him, despite Flo insisting she go too. But at least she makes Bob take his toothbrush.
How long does she think he's going to be gone for?
She doesn't know. That's why he needs a toothbrush.
That's fair.
Back at Dressing Downs' factory, Gordon and Albert are tied down, and Albert is being tickle-tortured by Big Buds. Now, Albert won't spill where the seeds are, so Louis threatens to torture Gordon instead. Louis asks Sonny to pickle him in salad dressing, and Sonny's reaction...
Oh, are we quoting Jordan and Mark?
We got permission. We don't have to pay royalties.
What am I to make of this? What are we to make of this? Because this whole sequence here, if I had a nickel for every time that we've come across this in a D cartoon, I'd have two nickels. Which is weird that this has happened twice, guys. It's happened twice.
And it's not even by the same writers. What is in the water in this part of town?
Like, seriously, I have a theory that male kid show writers have feet fetishes, and this is not disproving my conspiracy theory at all.
And that doesn't even stop. It's mentioned that even before licking the feet got referenced, he was literally being tickled, tortured, which is one of many. How do I phrase this without being?
It is an associated trope.
There we go.
It's.
I wasn't wanting to use the F word.
The other nomenclature.
The other nomenclature for it? Yeah, this trope is a little disturbing, I'm sorry.
However, the type of dressing they threaten to use, spicy French, gives Gordon the idea to knock a bottle of it down into the ropes he's tied up in, burning through them and setting him free.
It's a spicy French dressing.
That's some really spicy dressing.
I wonder what peppers they used.
I wonder if I can get some.
Ooh. I think they use California Reapers.
So the escapees race into Salad Swamp, where, despite Albert wanting to get Gordon back to his family, Gordon insists that good salad dressing is the right of every man, woman, and child on Melmac.
I think good salad dressing is just the right of everyone in general.
I've also just now realized that Albert's buck teeth are actually part of his snout. I mean, I guess that works, considering his snout is his mouth, but it just looks really weird in some of these frames.
This rousing moment is interrupted by howling, and it turns out Louis' men are using blood pansies to pursue the duo.
Which are really creepy.
Yeah, they're pretty disturbing looking.
After commercials, Alf falls right into Albert's lab, where his brand of science turns a rubber chicken into a plastic pussy willow, getting them the seeds.
I do gotta say that this has one of my favorite it's a basic joke that gets done a lot, but for some reason it almost always gets at least a chuckle out of me, where the character, you know, picks up the item, starts caressing it, acts like it's the greatest thing ever, then, you know, he takes the seeds out and then just chunks it off screen like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That gag always gets a chuckle out of me.
We spot the male Shumways and Mr. Chisholm also arriving in the swamp, as Old Paint, the kiddie ride horse, finally breaks down. But being an inventor, Bob has some idea of what to do. Meanwhile, Albert exposits that Mount Snout erupts, or rather blows its nose, once a year, and he intends to spread the plastic seeds all over the region through it.
It's not a bad plan.
Yeah, it will prevent... Louis the Pruner from having a monopoly on the product. Via a periscope, Alf spots Louis's men and the blood pansies digging into the lab. So, taking some extra gas, they inflate another rubber chicken into an improvised balloon.
Which is followed by Alf saying, "Ha! I kill me!" for absolutely no reason.
Yeah, I think they were just looking for a place to horn chew in that line.
Yeah, because it's one of his, it's like, well, we got to put in one of his catchphrases. We haven't said no problem yet, so just throw in a "ha, I kill me" there.
Yeah, I felt like when he did it, I'm like, that's not an appropriate spot for that, but okay.
Yeah, because usually he says that after he says a usually bad joke, so.
Yeah.
Well, rubber chickens are associated with bad jokes, so...
No problem!
It's still a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Curtis spots them, just as Bob finishes with old paint, which explodes.
Well, he was an amateur inventor, so...
Emphasis on amateur.
Yeah.
Bob insists they still must save his son, so he does the only thing he can. He takes over old paint's role as horse.
Aw, horsey ride.
Does an impressive job of it, too.
No kidding.
I think Bob's stronger than we realize.
Approaching Mount Snout, which activated a long-buried memory of this very sequence, inspiring childhood crayon drawings out of me. Both protagonists and antagonists are nearly there, as Sunny flies the ladder's aircraft into the rubber chicken, deflating it dramatically. But even the prospect of crashing has Alf saying, "No problem!" hanging on one of the three snouts as Chisholm and the Shumways also begin to approach.
Yeah, the fact that they have Alf saying "No problem" here makes his "I kill me" line feel very, even more...
Random.
Random and not needed.
No problem!
In the distance, a national park ranger explains it takes 10,000 tons of sinus spray to keep Mount Snout clear annually. But nothing stops the late summer buildup.
Sounds like my nose.
Sounds like everyone's allergies so far this year.
Louis and his henchmen crash land right on top of the snout Albert and Gordon are hanging for dear life off of, just as the rubber snaps.
Which, there's a lot of detail into that stretching and breaking rubber on there.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like they're trying to like build tension up, but I'm also kind of sitting there when Sunny's like, "There's nowhere for you to go now." And part of me is like, "Dude, are you sure about that?"
Yeah, they're building tension as the rubber loses it. The Rangers intervene with trampoline, sending them back up, and Sunny grabs the seeds, only for Bob to snatch them.
Good job, Bob.
I know. He did good.
Yeah. He confidently says he's Chisholm's sidekick, but realizes Chisholm and Curtis went up the wrong snout.
Oh. Do you really want to be Chisholm's sidekick? Let's be honest.
I know. But I have to give them kudos. That was actually kind of well timed. It was like, "I'm Chisholm's sidekick. Actually, we're over here." We went the wrong way.
Badly outnumbered, Bob threatens to drop the seeds as Gordon rises once more to tell him to launch them in the nose. Only Mount Snout is about to blow its top. And in the rumbling, Bob loses his grip and Sunny grabs the seeds. Only for him to tumble into the nose.
Yeah, which is pretty good.
So everything works out.
So,
it does.
Yeah, Louie and Big Buds follow into the nose just as it sneezes. And the propulsion causes the Rangers to tilt the trampoline, which sends Gordon and Albert right at the Shumway camper. And they're saved by Flo's quick thinking and an inflatable pool.
And the action movie logic that, you know, water will save you and not be like hitting a plane of cement.
I don't know if that's action movie logic or Looney Tunes logic.
They do it in a lot of action movies. Which, with... Because I remember MythBusters did an episode that was just all about like disproving action logic from action movies, and that was one of them. They're like, "No, if you hit like water from like a high distance, it's not going to save you. It's like hitting a plate of cement at that point."
Well, yeah,
the distance they were hitting it from was lower than what they were originally doing, and also the diagonal might have changed the trajectory a little.
Or it's just a cartoon show.
It's just a cartoon show too.
Well, it's cartoon logic at this point.
Yeah. But still, we can give it we can give it a slight bit of leeway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the trampoline effect alone, like if you hit a trampoline from that kind of distance, you would not be bouncing off the trampoline. You would be going through the trampoline.
That's one.
Yeah.
That could be just one heck of a trampoline. Alien trampoline.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're applying logic to an alien world and it's a cartoon. So as far as I'm concerned, this logic, because it's a silly show, we don't need to go there.
Yep.
Louis and his goons, meanwhile, have been sneezed right into the recently re-raised animatronic back at their park.
Yeah, they deserve that.
And the plastic seeds are spreading just as Albert wanted them to. I don't think he intended the sheer quantity of allergens, however.
You know, it's the price you pay for salad dressing.
From the inflatable pool, Chisholm calls the camper to ride into the sunset, which Puppet Alf is typing as we return to him to close the episode as driving off into the very dark and very stormy night.
No.
We need to work on his definition of dark and stormy night. Because I think his version of dark and stormy night is a bright and sunny day.
Well, it makes the story sound better.
That's fair.
So all things considered, this is actually a pretty decent cartoon.
Yeah, the animation quality is really good in it.
Yeah.
The art's really good. It's very imaginative.
Well, I think this shows off Deke's potential. If they're given a good amount of money and they're just left, you know, they're let to do what they can do. And if they have a good staff, like, they can do good things.
And the writing tends to be better than average, barring a few spots where things just get dropped or picked up with little explanation.
Yeah, I mean, the gags are good. Again, the writing, like you said, is pretty good for the most part. It's definitely above average, definitely imaginative. This show's way better than I expected it to be honest.
The thing is with writing is we can get nitpicky, and we can get nitpicky, but with things being dropped or picked up in different areas, I'm okay with one or two things being dropped. If they're just little throwaway things like that pilot, we're going to need to be arrested. I mean, we hear Staff Sergeant says that he threatens to arrest people all the time for stupid things. It's his character. I'm okay with if it's a character quirk. Like, okay, dude, you threaten to arrest everyone. It's like Feral constantly in SWAT Cats threatening to arrest the SWAT Cats and then really does it. So there's things we can nitpick about, but overall, the writing is very good. A lot of this stuff was provided from the TV show, so it wasn't like they were going into blind and trying to create something with no feedback from the main creator. Like, they had to do with other established properties. Like, they had to go into some established properties without a whole lot of feedback from the main property itself. But we saw that with Nintendo, with some of the properties that Nintendo gave them. It was just like, yeah, here's the games, here's some of the manuals, figure it out.
Probably helps that Fusco was on staff as, like, voice actor, so he probably would say something if he felt the script wasn't good enough or something.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing that raised an eyebrow for me personally, but I would not call this a complaint, mm-hmm. I'm emphasizing that now, is Paul Fusco's lack of, shall we say, vertical range in his vocal delivery during the animated parts. He'll sound exactly the same when he's being pulled into a moving vehicle atop a mountain pass as he would standing in line for a Maine Coon Ripple at the ice cream stand, which can come off as odd sometimes.
Yeah,
I think it's basically the idea is Alf's just supposed to be kind of indifferent, or not exactly indifferent, but unbothered by everything, relaxed, I guess. But yeah, it does come off weird in certain segments.
And also, I think the other thing also, too, is there's a lot more difference that goes into being a voice actor than being on an actual stage in a sitcom.
Yeah. And on top of that, what works when you're being the main comedic element opposite the comparatively straight-laced Tanners might not work when you're having to be a comedic element against the backdrop of Melmac.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, and also too, but I'm also saying, like, being a voice actor, you have to be able, you're not always playing off of other people around you. You're literally in a booth alone with the script.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. So you're not always able, you have to, in your brain, you know, hoping that you're getting the inflection and everything right. Sometimes you have other people in the booth with you where they're across from you and you're talking and you're actually able to play off of them, or you're able to see what, or see the image of what your character is doing and have to, so you know what's going on. But sometimes you have to guess. I think Mark Hamill talked about it, where he sometimes would go into some of the voice acting gigs and he's blind to what they want. And he has to like throw out thousands and thousands of voices and inflections until they tell them which one they're like, yeah, that's the one we want. Like, you know, because he's like, you don't always know what they want. And that's the hard part from going from being a stage actor to a voice actor, is in stage acting, you have someone to play off of. So you know how to react to those emotions, where you don't always get that as a voice actor. It's a little harder.
Well, that you also have, as a stage actor, you also have your body to also help give you the emotion rather than just your voice. So, yeah.
Now, I couldn't find ratings information for the show, but it must have done well enough because it spawned a sister series the following year, Alf Tales, which took the same cast and had them perform fractured fairy tale-esque versions of vintage folk tales, mythology, and children's stories. This second series ran for 21 episodes across two seasons, while the main cartoon lasted for 26 episodes across the same number of seasons, putting them combined just short of being able to be packaged as a syndicated offering.
That sucks.
We almost covered Alf Tales here in this episode because of the production overlap, but we decided to look at it separately later down the line, either on its own or maybe paired with another, characters get put into familiar stories type of setup show.
Yeah, we're still kind of fighting about that.
Of course, by 1990, Alf would leave the live-action airwaves on a cliffhanger that saw him attempt to return to the rest of his people, but get captured by the military. A TV movie, Project Alf, would resolve the loose thread slightly less than 6 years later, and acted as a final grace note for Alf as a sitcom franchise.
Bring Alf back.
Oh. This doesn't mean he left pop culture altogether, of course. Alf would be a go-to punchline in the mid-90s for animated sitcoms like The Simpsons and The Critic.
But look, I got some cool pogs. Alf pogs. Remember Alf? He's back in pog form.
And he'd show up as a kitschy talk show host on the TV Land Network, as a regular panelist on Hollywood Squares' third incarnation, in a cameo in a parodical take on the book The Art of the Deal in 2016, and in commercials or other TV shows whenever someone wants to invoke 80s nostalgia.
And from what I understand, Paul Fusco's tried multiple times to break him back.
Yeah, he has. Yeah.
I think Sony mentioned possibly making a CG movie at one point, but that's the last I've heard.
I don't know if Alf would work as a CG movie. I don't think it would.
I definitely feel like he'd lose something by not being a puppet.
I agree.
Or a traditional cartoon.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I feel CGI wouldn't work.
And speaking of that, the animated Alf had one last hurrah in April of 1990, and this is likely the best time for us to talk about on this podcast.
Do I need to make an appointment with your therapist?
No, we're going to briefly talk Cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue.
You know, I have actually never watched that.
If you do, it's going to probably be a group watching with all three of us, because, you know, you're probably going to want the emotional support.
You see, in this, Alf joins a veritable who's who of popular kids' media properties of the day to create a preachy anti-drug PSA disguised as the biggest cartoon team-up since Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Airing on all the major networks, plus USA, Nickelodeon, and elsewhere, it was funded by McDonald's, introduced by U.S. President and First Lady George and Barbara Bush, and was a source of nightmares for young kids expecting Papa Smurf and the Muppet Babies doing fun things, and instead getting a smoky antagonist voiced by George C. Scott, of all people, raising all kinds of visual hell.
Yeah, the last smoky antagonist that I got was from Ferngully. I think that was with Tim Curry as the voice. Still was a little nightmare fuel.
While yes, Cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue is technically on the list, It's rock freaking bottom on it. We'll do Rickety Rocket and the Ren and Stimpy show before we even touch that thing, and we're in absolutely no hurry to do either of those two shows.
And I think this is, we can't...
Regardless how popular one of those is.
Yeah, Rickety Rocket, I think it's because we can't find the episodes, and I am not touching Ren or Stimpy with a 10-foot pole. Not one of my favorite shows at all.
I just don't want to have to deal with talking about its creator.
Me neither.
And I wasn't a fan of the show originally anyways, but still, that there's an elephant in the room there that I just know.
No.
As for Rickety Rocket, I actually recently found 4 episodes of him. I have yet watched it. I'll put it that way.
Oh my god, you did?
Yes. Well, technically someone in the YouTube comments directed me to them. Because I keep getting requested that, and I was just always like, no, I can't find episodes, and yeah,
someone
I
have took more away. Now. Someone took away your excuse.
Yep.
Today, Shout Factory owns all things ALF and has provided episodes of the cartoon to YouTube, which is the easiest place to find them. They're in bad need of a remastering.
There's also a couple of other YouTube creators that have created lists of some of the ALF cartoons that are not quite in bad of a condition as the Shout Factory ones. I did find a few that actually looked really, really good.
Oh, good.
On YouTube. So I did find a couple that looked in a little bit better quality than the Shout Factory ones.
This is more to the earlier statement. I made the comment about the CGI thing from Sony. I just did a quick look on Wikipedia on that. That actually was announced in August 2012. Sony Pictures Animation had acquired the rights to ALF and would develop the property into a CGI live-action hybrid feature along with Fusco and Tom Patchett, but that never happened. And then again, in August 1st, 2018, Warner Brothers announced that it would produce an ALF reboot, but that also didn't happen, and that has been announced as being canceled.
So yeah, there's been more than a few talks of revivals over the last 2 decades. But so far, that's all it's been. And for that, cats everywhere are relieved.
Lucky caught a break.
Warner Brothers canceled something? Shock!
I was about to say, given Warner Brothers' track record, who's surprised? Who is surprised?
Oh.
I still have my eyes on you about that Wile E. Coyote movie, Warner Brothers. I'm
coming
for you.
All three of us.
Do you think it's time to restock the Fancy Feast?
Who has a cat?
I do.
Oh, yeah,
well,
that's great. Well,
technically my roommate has 3, but, you know, it counts.
It counts. Okay, we can go get Fancy Feast for the kitties.
And breakfast cereal for us.
Indeed. Let's go, boys. There was an ALF cereal, wasn't there?
I think so. And before you get up for that final snack, I want you to know I've got your cat! Ha!
I kill me! Ha!
No problem.
Good night, everybody.
Bye!
Pemmy?
See ya!
Thank you. The Pemmy and James can sort of hopefully funny cartoon podcast! The preceding podcast is a co-production of the Mighty Monkey Corporation and Artificial Orange Studios. The theme song is written, composed, and performed by Shawn Michael Smith. For questions and comments, email me at james@fc3roc.org.